Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Frisch, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is October 25, 2023. This panel of the court today has three cases on its agenda, all three of which will be submitted with oral arguments. I apologize for our slight delay in getting started. We had a technical issue, but we've resolved that. And so I think, and by the way, we are hearing oral arguments by Zoom at the moment, but I think our technical issues are resolved. So we're ready to go forward now. I will call the first case. The first case is case number A23-598. First and First LLC versus Chadco of Duluth LLC. Counsel, I believe you're familiar with our protocols. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Ryan Dreyer, and I'm representing the appellants First and First LLC and Grand Central Duluth LLC. And may it please the court, we're here asking that the Minnesota Court of Appeals reverse the district court's denial of our temporary restraining order and remand this issue for issuance of that TRO. There are really three points that I want to make here today, and these are laid out in our brief. The first point is that when a party breaches a contract to sell real estate, money damages are presumed to be inadequate in Minnesota law. Second point I want to make is that the Dahlberg factors, as applied to the facts of this case, as they were presented to the district court on April 20th, strongly favor First and First in an issuance of the TRO. And the third point I want to make is kind of a secondary point, but it's that service of the statutory notice of cancellation pursuant to Minnesota Statute 559.21 does not terminate the contract automatically. It only triggers potentially a 30-day cancellation provision.
Counsel, is the essence of your argument that the district court is divested of its discretion to determine the propriety of an injunction in a case where we're dealing with a wrongful cancellation of a purchase agreement, that there's no discretion?
No, absolutely not. The court maintains its discretion, but not on the issue of whether money damages are adequate. That's already been decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court in the Shaughnessy case. And in the Shaughnessy case, the Minnesota Supreme Court has adopted the rule that, quote, damages for the breach of a contract for the sale and purchase of any interest in land is always considered inadequate without regard to the size, the value, or location of the land, or the possibility of getting other land substantially equivalent, close quote. The court goes on.
And that's not in an injunction case, correct?
That was not in an injunction case, but it was a case applying equitable remedies, the equitable remedy of specific performance, which is the same type of remedy that we sought here, specific performance, and also the equitable remedy of an injunction. And so that's one of the...
So is there any case in Minnesota that stands for the proposition that a district court lacks the discretion to make a decision about irreparable harm given a particular circumstances of a case in the injunction context?
Yeah, I believe it's this Shaughnessy decision because the Supreme Court has said it's always inadequate. Money damages are always inadequate. And then the Supreme Court in that case goes on to say, in short, inadequacy of damages is presumed and proof thereof is not required. This presumption is sound. And so that has...
So in this case, the district court also made a factual finding that the case is all about, it's all about money. I think that's what the district court said. It's all about money. And you're not challenging, you're not arguing that that was a clearly erroneous factual determination. So what do we make of that? Are you saying that the district court had no authority to make a decision based on the facts of this case?
We dispute that that is a fact finding, and we dispute, and we didn't even present evidence of that because we don't have to. Minnesota law says that the inadequacy of damages is presumed, which means we don't have to offer proof of it. We didn't.
What case says that? Johnson. I mean, the cases, the presumption cases that you're citing, one is from the Eighth Circuit and one is from some other federal district court. Is there some case in Minnesota that says that money damages are that there's a presumption?
Yes. The Shaughnessy decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court. It's 23 Northwest 2D 362, and it's a 1946 Minnesota Supreme Court decision. That's the case that I've been quoting from this morning. And it does stand for the proposition that it is presumed that money damages are inadequate when you are suing over the failure of a party to perform a purchase agreement for real estate. And so that is the presumption. That's why we didn't bring evidence of inadequacy of money damages to the district court. And it was improper and it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to make a fact finding on that issue. It's not required. The law doesn't require it. The Minnesota Supreme Court has already said you don't even have to consider it.
And your argument then is that that as the moving party for injunctive relief, you're absolved of your responsibility to demonstrate the five Dahlberg factors, that absolutely this Dahlberg factor is just, you don't have to prove it affirmatively?
Well, this isn't the Dahlberg factor. The five Dahlberg factors are separate and independent of this determination. But no, our position is that a moving party in this situation still has to demonstrate that it's entitled to relief under the Dahlberg factors. And that's the second point of my argument today, was to demonstrate and go through some of the evidence that was presented to the district court on this issue. And we should start with what the burden of proof is in a Dahlberg analysis. And it is that the moving party has to make a quote unquote prima facie showing that it's entitled to relief. And in this case, there was lots of evidence presented to the district court that First and First was entitled to relief. And when you apply the Dahlberg factors, specifically likelihood of success on the merits, the most important evidence there is that it was not First and First who had breached. It was the Chadco parties who could not perform their obligations under the purchase agreement. It's undisputed that they were required to deliver marketable title under the purchase agreement. They had to give us a warranty deed. Under Minnesota statute section 507.07, a warranty deed includes the covenant of season and also the comply with that warranty deed requirement, because it didn't own title to three of the parcels that were part of the purchase agreement. They were Torrens parcels with certificates of title that listed other owners on those certificates of title. And both parties knew that. Both parties were working toward resolving that issue and knew that Chadco, the seller, had to get title into its name under those certificates of title so that it could issue a warranty deed to my client First and First. And so the parties were working toward that, and the evidence that they were working toward that is Exhibit T and Exhibit S and Exhibit N as attached to Index Number 3. These are the exhibits attached to the Declaration of Peter Remisch. And each of these exhibits show that long after January 30th, the parties were working toward a closing. They were working on their mutual performances under the purchase agreement to get to the closing. And that included getting title into Chadco's name so that it could meet its obligations under the purchase agreement. So because Chadco couldn't perform, it wasn't First and First who had breached, it was Chadco. But First and First, my client, wasn't coming into court suing Chadco for breach of contract. They were just saying, hey, let's work toward a closing date. We'll get this done. We'll get there. But the second reason that we had a strong showing of likelihood of success on the merits at the April 20th hearing is because Chadco, before they can complain and sue us or try to cancel the contract and claim that we breached, they have to tender their performance under the contract. And that's the law in Minnesota under the Bell v. Olson case. And what that requires a party to do is to do everything you can do under your contract to tender your performance. And then that triggers the other party's performance, in this case, First and First performance. And if First and First doesn't perform after Chadco tenders its complete performance under the purchase agreement, then First and First has breached the contract. And it would trigger the right under Section 559.21 to initiate a statutory cancellation procedure. But that didn't happen here. Chadco never tendered its performance, and there's evidence of that in the record. Again, exhibit number Exhibit number T to index number 3 in the record is a March 30th, 2023 email from Chadco's attorney where he's asking first and first for Word documents, Word copies, Word versions of Chadco's, the seller's closing documents. They hadn't even started putting their closing documents together by March 30th. And they're asking us for the Word documents. Of course, we gave them to them, but that just shows you that Chadco had never tendered its full performance under the contract. That makes its notice of cancellation improper. And that means that First and First had a high likelihood of success on the merits of this case because the notice of cancellation was improper. It was void from the second it was issued. And
Mr. Dry, I'd like to go back to the first issue that you were arguing about. Why is your interest in specific performance after at final judgment, why is your interest in that remedy not adequately protected by the notice of list pendants?
Well, that's a good question. This gets into a problem that I see with this statute, and it's that the statute cancels the contract if the buyer or one of the parties under the contract doesn't either cure the defaults and close within the 30-day cancellation period or get a TRO. And in this case, you know, we tried to close. Chadco refused to close during the 30-day period. So then we had to go to court and try to get a TRO. We didn't get the TRO. If you look at the way the statute operates, and I think this is going to be Chadco's argument, they're going to say, you don't have a contract anymore. You don't have a specific performance right anymore. And that's by operation of Section 559.21. And so the list pendants really doesn't do anything to protect our right for specific performance.
Is it still in place? I mean, is that notice still in place?
It is. It is still.
And why is it at risk?
It's at risk because if you look at the language and the operation of Section 559.21, and I think this is going to be Chadco's argument, the purchase agreement is canceled by operation of that statute. So it's no longer in place. So we can't have specific performance of a contract that doesn't exist. And that's going to be their argument. And so, you know, I think like a good point here, though, is that specific performance is an equitable remedy. So is temporary injunction. These are both remedies that are available to a party.
Counsel, to Judge Johnson's point, doesn't the combination of initiating the underlying lawsuit and filing the notice of list pendants protect your claim until the disposition of the merits of the action? I mean, if there is a breach and that's determined on the merits, then you have protected your interests by filing the notice, haven't you?
Well, I think the notice of list pendants provides some protection, right? It's going to be noticed to any party who's going to deal with that real estate that there's a lawsuit involving title to the real estate and that they would take subject to that. But that doesn't stop a sale from happening. And
the sale would be void or voidable by virtue of the notice if you ended up prevailing, wouldn't it?
Potentially it would be, yes. But another reason that we don't believe that the notice of list pendants provides the entire protection is that if that was the case, all the legislature would have had to do when it passed 559.21 is say, start a lawsuit and file a notice of list pendants. But that's not what the statute says. It says go into court and get a TRO. And so that's why, you know, we did both. We recorded the notice of list pendants and we went into court and sought the temporary restraining order. And again, back to the original explanation, it's because the operation of Section 559.21 is going to terminate that contract. So if the contract's terminated, there's nothing to specifically perform. That's why the notice of list pendants doesn't really matter at this stage if there's no contract. And operation of 559.21 is going to wipe out that contract.
And but so, isn't the cancellation, isn't that one of the issues that's pending before the court and needs to be determined? And let me add to that question, perhaps a compound question, but help me, I mean, play out for me what you think might happen in the future, what you fear might happen in the future. Are you afraid that opposing party is going to bring a motion before the court to remove the list pendants? And if so, can that be done without a final determination of all of the issues that are pleaded in your complaint?
Yes, I do believe that that would be the type of motion that Chadco would bring. And it's sort of based on the district court's error by determining that money damages were adequate. If the court is saying that money damages are adequate, it's already looking past the specific performance remedy. And it's just saying, like, you know what, we'll just figure out how much you're owed first and first, and we'll get you a check, or we'll enter a judgment in favor of Chadco, or in favor of first and first from Chadco, you'll get made whole. But the court's looking past transferring title to first and first already. And so we are very concerned that that's exactly what's going to happen here, is that when we get back to district court, the Chadco will just say, well, judge, since you've already decided that money damages are adequate and that title is really not an issue in this case anymore, get rid of that list pendant so that we can sell it. So we believe that's what's coming. And that's why we believe that we are entitled to equitable relief in the form of a temporary restraining order on this issue.
I have another question about how we analyze these issues. I guess I was thinking that this issue about, I think what you're arguing is basically irreparable harm. Am I correct? Is that the term?
Yes.
Isn't that basically incorporated into the second Dahlberg factor about balancing of harms? In other words, you presented it as a separate threshold issue, and then separately we apply the five Dahlberg factors. It seems to me that the harm that might be forced upon your client by the loss of your right to seek specific performance is part of that balancing of harms in the second factor. I'm just trying to get the proper analytical framework for how the court should decide the case.
I see my time's expired, but I'd like to answer your question if you would approve.
Yeah. Yes, you may.
So we think that, you know, my understanding of the law is that whether or not money damages are adequate is an independent factor courts have to look at when faced with a motion for a temporary injunction. And then if they find that, yes, money damages are inadequate, then you look to the Dahlberg factors. One of those is the balance of harms. In this case, it aligns up. So it's a nice coincidence where the balance of harms strongly favors first and first, because if we're wrong and we don't get the temporary injunction, operation of section 559.21 wipes out our contract, wipes out our right to specific performance, and ends our ability to get title to the property. So the harm to first and first is massive. It's the death penalty under the contract, essentially. The other side of that analysis is that there's really no harm to Chadco if the temporary injunction is granted, because they get to stay in title. They get to remain the landlord of all these tenants. They get to keep collecting all the rent on these properties and paying the debts that they have on the property. So, you know, you look at the balance of harms here, and it strongly favors first and first, because it's the death penalty to us under the contract. And it's really no harm to Chadco if the temporary injunction is granted. So, again, to answer your question specifically, one, we think that adequacy of money damages is an independent factor that has to be applied before the Dahlberg factors. But in this case, when you look at them, they kind of collapse into that second element, the second Dahlberg factor, but they strongly favor first and first.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Dreyer. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. James Magnuson on behalf of Chadco Duluth, LLC. And I think the questions posed by the court get to the core issue of this case. First of all, I think it's very important that we keep it well in mind the standard that appellants must reach in order to overturn this decision. This is a matter that is largely an exercise of judicial discretion, and there must be a clear abuse of discretion to overturn it. And the district court went through and analyzed the Dahlberg factors, but more importantly, analyzed this factor of irreparable harm. That was the one factor, immediate and irreparable harm, that is set forth in Minnesota Rule 65. That was the basis for the court. And as we set forth in our brief, and I won't get into it exhaustively here, but as we set forth in our brief, we think that the other Dahlberg factors also support Chadco's opposition to this motion. However, the issue is immediate and irreparable harm. And we are in a position, Your Honors, where we're able to actually see whether immediate and irreparable harm suggested by appellants was actually in prospect. We have had 6 months since this temporary restraining order was sought. And during that time, the Liz pendants has been in place. During that time, Chadco has not signed any purchase agreements for the sale of the property. There's been no waste of the property. During that time, Chadco has continued to operate as owner of the property, and in no way have appellant's interests been any faced any diminution that could not be completely solved with their specific performance claim.
So those things, I'm sorry.
Counsel, hypothetically, if your client chose to make a motion to remove the list pendants from the property, and then the motion for temporary injunction were renewed, would we be in a different position?
I think absolutely, Your Honor, because I would say that one of the most important factors to the district court in its discretion and as laid out in the order was that the list pendants was in place. And I'll simply note, Your Honor, that appellants have suggested, oh, well, Chadco could move to get rid of the list pendants. In the time period since that order was issued, Chadco has made no attempt to do so.
Well, while the appeal is pending, I mean, that I can understand why you wouldn't. But if we were to affirm, are you asserting that you would never bring such a motion until final judgment?
Well, Your Honor, obviously it's difficult as a lawyer to say never, but I will say this. In speaking to my client, I have heard nothing about any motion for a list pendants. That is certainly not in Chadco's plans. Chadco is just continuing on to try to take this litigation to where it needs to be taken to. There is an appeal in place, Your Honor, but proceedings have gone forward in the district court to some extent. Discovery has gone forward. This matter being on appeal, it's my perspective, Your Honor, that we could have brought a motion on the Liz pendants if we had chose to and did not choose to, Your Honor. Whether or not that is correct or not, the point is that Chadco, from my perspective, could have brought that motion, has not chosen to. And Your Honor, again, we make that claim throughout in our response brief, is that this is the protection that they are claiming that they need. This plus the remedy of specific performance gives them the right to try to require this contract, which from our perspective has been canceled and therefore is not operative. But they have the right to seek performance of this under this remedy, and any potential buyer would take subject to this remedy. Your Honor, in light of this, we don't think that there's any irreparable harm and certainly no immediate harm, because in the months that have gone since this action went forward, this denial of this motion took place, nothing has happened. There has been no injury to them and certainly no irreparable injury.
So the district court was, I think, clear in its determination that the resolution of the balance of harms factor under among the Dahlberg factors was dispositive of injunctive relief. If we determine that the district court did not abuse its discretion in that respect, in those findings, in that conclusion, do we need to reach the other Dahlberg factors?
Your Honor, I would say no. The district court, again, we're in a position, and I've made this argument simply to preserve some of these arguments in terms of likelihood of success on the merits. We want to preserve these arguments so that they're not waived. However, from our perspective, Your Honor, the district court's determination that the other Dahlberg factors don't support either party is entitled to the same amount of discretionary weight as its determination on the balance of harms. So, Your Honor, if from our perspective, if the court upheld the finding on the balance of harms and that was within the district court's discretion, it wouldn't need to reach anything else.
Can you address the this proposition, which I think is a novel one, speaking for myself and not for my colleagues, that because there is a request for specific performance as part of the remedy and this cancellation of a purchase agreement involving real property, that irreparable harm is presumed, or that money damages can never be adequately, be an adequate compensatory remedy?
Well, Your Honor, again, I think whether or not, the issue at hand is not whether they have an entitlement to the remedy of specific performance. This is a temporary injunction hearing and an appeal from a denial of an order issuing a temporary injunction. So it's important to note that we are not here to state whether they have demonstrated, again, success on the potential success on the merits wasn't a basis for the court's order. And in the temporary injunction context, as far as I'm aware, there's been not a single Minnesota case that finds, as a result of this language related to specific performance, that a movement is entitled, therefore, to a determination that they have demonstrated irreparable harm and a balance of the harms would be in their favor as a result of this language in the specific performance context. And in fact, Your Honor, as we cited in our brief, there are a couple of cases, one from the Minnesota Court of Appeals and one from the District Court, in which the court has specifically rejected this form of argument and has said, we understand that in a specific performance context, there's case law suggesting that that specific performance is a possible remedy for cancellation of a purchase agreement because of the unique character of land. However, in a temporary injunction context, the district court is required to weigh all of the factors and examine all of the facts and to determine whether an injunction should issue based on the facts of that case as a whole, not give such weight simply to that factor. And so, Your Honor, as the cases we've cited have suggested, there are certainly cases in which, based on the circumstances and facts of the case, courts have rejected motions for temporary injunctions to stop a cancellation of the purchase agreement. And so, Your Honor, again, the district court was in a position to evaluate the arguments of counsel and the written submissions of counsel. I will simply also note, by the way, some of the arguments being made by appellants today were not really before the district court, as far as I know. As far as I know, I wasn't a counsel for Chadco at this time. I was not present at the hearing, but it's my understanding that there were not arguments made at the hearing as to whether specific performance was a remedy available to appellants that were made before the district court. So I will simply note that. But going back Your Honor.
Mr. Magnuson, yes. So looking at Shaughnessy, if the inadequacy of damages is presumed and proof of damages is not required at final judgment, I mean, why wouldn't that same principle apply on a motion for temporary injunction? In other words, I mean, the whole purpose of the motion for temporary injunction is to, I think the purpose is to hold the status quo and so that at least if all of the factors are based on the district court's analysis of the factors, if it's appropriate, if it's equitable, the district court can hold the status quo so that plaintiffs' potential remedies are preserved. But that principle about inadequacy of damages, I don't understand why that would not operate in the same way at the temporary injunction stage or TRO stage as it would at final judgment.
Because again, Your Honor, I think it's important to remember that temporary injunction is not meant to be a commonplace remedy. It's meant to be a remedy that's extraordinary and in particular related to an immediate and irreparable harm. And that's what it says in Rule 65. This is not simply, hey, I would like this. This is, I need this because of this potential harm that is not going to be repaired based on the claims and the cause of action. Your Honor.
Wouldn't it be an irreparable harm if the plaintiffs disputed right to acquire the property in a purchase agreement is frustrated by another transaction in which the property is sold to somebody else. I mean, in other words, if that were to occur, wouldn't that be an irreparable harm?
Well, Your Honor, again, number one, as a practical matter and as a factual matter, the district court determined that that wasn't likely. And I think that that's entitled to great weight. But second, I don't believe it would be an irreparable harm, Your Honor, because again, the Liz Pendens would operate to allow for specific performance against this new buyer, the same as it would against us. That's the purpose of a Liz Pendens. And so, Your Honor, I don't think it places them in any worse position, even if Chadco were to attempt to sell and any buyer were to attempt to buy, which again, Your Honor, in the months since this has gone forward, there's been absolutely nothing of that nature. There's been nothing to suggest that that potential harm is either likely, imminent, or as we've been stating, irreparable.
So if we state this differently, is what you're really arguing that their potential remedy of specific performance, if they prevail on the merits, remains in place regardless of whether the injunction issues? There's no need for temporary relief because they would continue to have that right if they ended up prevailing at the end of the day.
Exactly, Your Honor. And we stated that in our brief. We said they don't need temporary relief because there's no imminent injury and no irreparable injury with the Liz Pendens in place and the specific performance remedy that they seek. If they win at the end of the case, they will get the relief that they seek. There's no need to try to put in this difficult and costly and potentially just complicated remedy when they can get what they seek through the things that they are seeking in their complaint.
Would your answer be the same if the Liz Pendens were removed for some reason?
No, Your Honor, and we've stated that the district court specifically found that Liz Pendens was extremely important to its analysis. And Your Honor, whether or not in that hypothetical, we would argue that they are still protected because we are not attempting to sell the property and are not selling the property. I don't know, but Your Honor, certainly in terms of the district court's analysis, which we believe was justified, that Liz Pendens provides the protection that appellants are saying that they need in this kind of temporary emergency injunctive context. So, Your Honor, just finally, I will say on the likelihood of success on the merits, without getting into it too much, because I know my time is very short, I would simply say that on the issue of title, what matters is what was in the purchase agreement. The purchase agreement gave them the right to review, make objections to the title and survey, and then if not, those objections were waived. Our argument is that First and the other appellants were the ones in breach and not Chadco. So they're not entitled to, they have not demonstrated likelihood of success on the merits. And for those reasons, Your Honor, we would ask that the district court order be upheld. Thank you, Your Honor.
So, counsel, are you saying that your client could provide full title at this point?
Your Honor, we could provide.
I mean, that's the most important thing you've got to do, really.
Well, Your Honor, we are in a position where we could provide exactly the title that we obtained. And not only the title that we obtained, but the title that we refinanced with. These are issues with title that have been going back for generations. Now, whether they should have been cleaned up, they could be cleaned up by any potential buyer exactly as they could be cleaned up by Chadco. There is nobody, as far as I know, who's making alternative claims to this property. There's issues with, there's 17 parcels or something. I mean, there's a ton of parcels. There's issues with them. I understand that, Your Honor, but I would absolutely say that Chadco could convey the exact title that it obtained, that it has been using and operating as owner under the entire time that it has been in possession of the property. And so as a result, Your Honor, we still think that this is not any impediment to a sale, especially in light of the failure to object. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Magnuson. Mr. Dreyer, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. I would like to address a couple of points that counsel just made. To begin with, the argument that they are in a position, Chadco is in a position to deliver the same title that they received. Well, that's a quitclaim deed. A quitclaim deed is when you just turn over whatever title you have to the buyer and you make no representations of, or warranties about it. But the contract, unambiguously, and this is undisputed, required delivery of a warranty deed, far different than a quitclaim deed. And therefore, I think when you apply what a warranty deed is to counsel's arguments, that's an admission that they still can't produce title. And we understand that, and we're willing to work with the sellers to go through the process to get them clean title so they can deliver it to us. Second thing I wanted to say is that, you know, this argument that the Liz Pendens protects first and first rights, and it sounds like there's a stipulation that we are entitled to specific performance if we prove the elements of a breach of contract claim. And so the other question then is, well, what's the harm if the temporary restraining order is issued? I mean, they're saying that they will comply with, you know, the rights that First and First might have under the contract. So I don't understand why they object to issuance of a temporary restraining order unless something else is going to happen. And that's what we're worried about. And the reason that First and First moved forward with motion for a temporary restraining order, then this appeal, is because Chadco has triggered this process under Section 559.21 that jeopardizes all of First and First rights under the purchase agreement and to this land. We didn't want this process thrust upon us. It was thrust upon us by Chadco, and we feel like we have to pursue a temporary restraining order and reversal of the denial of the temporary restraining order so that we still have rights in the land and so that we still have rights in this purchase agreement and we have the ability to purchase it. Because under our interpretation of the law, we don't have that if we don't either close within the 30 days after service of the notice or get a TRO. And again, that's I don't like the wording of the statute. I think it creates problems for the courts, but that's the way the statute is worded, and it thrusts buyers into this situation. That's why we've gone forward with the appeal and pursued it. Final point I want to make is on the standard of review. Standard of review here definitely is abuse of discretion, but a court abuses its discretion when it misapplies Minnesota law, and that's what the district court has done here. The district court has created a distinction between the equitable remedy of temporary relief and specific performance. But if we're entitled to specific performance because money damages are inadequate, as counsel and the court seems to suggest, then we're also entitled to the other equitable remedies that are available to parties in Minnesota, including temporary relief. There's no distinction between those remedies when it comes to whether or not money damages are adequate. Counsel hasn't cited any authority for a distinction. The district court didn't cite any authority for a distinction. They're asking for new law, and that just doesn't exist. There's no authority to make that distinction. And therefore, all the cases that talk about money damages being inadequate in relation to a specific performance remedy apply with equal force to temporary relief.
And so is it your claim, and I'm kind of returning to the very first question that I asked you, counsel, is it your claim that a district court has no discretion when the assertion for relief is specific performance in the context of real property and determining whether irreparable harm exists?
It's close. It's very limited. And the Shaughnessy case and other cases limit it only to specific performance of a purchase agreement involving an interest in real estate.
So if there is an allegation of specific performance that you're seeking specific performance in this real estate context, your claim is that a district court has zero discretion in its determination of this Dahlberg factor.
Yes.
And what Minnesota law stands for that proposition in the injunction context?
While in the injunction contest, I don't have a case that says that in the injunction contest. It's the Shaughnessy case when it's applying it to specific performance. And then again, we cite this in our brief, and I think you referred to this case. It's an Eighth Circuit case. It says irreparable injury is conclusively presumed from the refusal of one to perform his contract to convey real property.
And in your Mitchell case, the other case that you cite, it says that irreparable harm is not conclusively presumed.
It says loss of an interest in real property is generally considered irreparable harm.
But then it says it's also not presumed, right?
I don't have that language in front of me. That may be. But at least in Minnesota, it is conclusively presumed under the Shaughnessy case. I see that my time has expired. I'm happy to answer any other questions the court may have. Otherwise, we ask that the court reverse and instruct the district court to issue the temporary restraining order.
Thank you, Mr. Dreyer. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.